This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You probably recognize the name Hodding Carter III if you watched the news much in 1979. That was the year Islamic militants in Iran took over the American embassy. They held 52 U.S. citizens captive for more than a year. Americans demanded answers from President Jimmy Carter's administration. Hodding Carter was the man who tried to give them. He served as State Department spokesman while Jimmy Carter was president, became nearly a household name during the Iran hostage crisis. Hodding Carter III had never planned on a career in politics. His father ran the Delta Democrat Times in Greenville, Mississippi, a progressive voice against racism in the Jim Crow South. Hodding inherited a love of journalism from his father, eventually became editor of the paper, continued the fight for civil rights into the 1960s, but gradually he felt he had to do more than write about politics. He wanted to get involved. His activism led him to Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign and eventually the State Department job. Now he's a professor of leadership and public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's in our studio now to talk more about that journey. Hodding Carter, welcome. Good evening.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Frank.
Tell us about those days growing up in Greenville. Your father had already established a reputation as going against the grain down there. What was it like for you as a young man?
Well, we came back from the war in 1945. Dad won a Pulitzer Prize immediately for writing very vigorous editorials attacking the racist leadership of Mississippi, which established that these somewhat distant folk who had been gone for 4 years in the war were crazy, communists, all the other words that you can think of. And I, who had a Yankee accent from having been gone in the far north of Silver Spring, Maryland, the son of the integrationist communist, was in a school filled with children whose parents told him what crazy sons of guns we were. So it was a little tight for a few years to be the new boy on the block who was not only new but alien insofar as the family's position on the number one issue for all white folks in that state. I want to say that because that was real. To add quickly, however, that I was not an isolated little boy all by myself. I had plenty of friends, lots of a life that was more complex than the persecuted outsider. But boy, I knew one thing. There were a lot of people who hated us.
How did you handle that? I mean, did you ever get the impulse to say, Dad, let's just knock it off down here?
I took it to be the way it was at first and was used to the whole notion of people calling out and threatening to kill and having guns all over the place and all of that. As I got into my teen years, I would have been happier to be able to think that at least some of those girls weren't looking at me as the outsider. And yes, of course. I mean, particularly at that middle teen period, there were times I was thinking, hey, why don't we throw this in? Or, come on, cool it down a little bit so I can have a life. Well, I did have a life, but it was from time to time not amusing.
How did the paper do well at all? Clearly, it sold and it survived. And so it must have been something in that paper people liked.
What we did was we covered that community in ways which are considered highly unprofessional by professional journalists. We were tireless boosters. We covered everything that walked. Names made news. We also, of course, held up the mirror to the warts as well, which was unamusing. But frankly, a lot of them did hold that old idea, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch, and that mattered. We were a really good community paper, and we really meant it. We thought Greenville was very important. That was one thing. The second thing was the editorial position of that paper was taken in a community in which a significant number of the white leadership were not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, Jews, Lebanese, Chinese, Irish, who had come there as serfs or semi-serfs or as just off the boats, and frankly understood that if the bad boys actually won, it wasn't that they didn't like blacks. They didn't like any kind of not white. And we were sort of the in-between force. They may have thought we were crazy, but they also thought we were a bulwark, and that mattered a lot.
And did you get the sense that there may have been a lot more support? I mean, you talked about the fact that not everybody was Anglo-Saxon, but other kinds of support, people who secretly hated the institution but publicly had to say what they said to you.
There were certainly those who were in that category. Not a lot of them came running around the back door saying, we're the voice at the back door and we're telling you we're with you, but enough that you had that sense. But believe me, you don't want to go too far down that road. White supremacy had been the orthodoxy and indeed the secular religion for as long as there was a Mississippi and the South. And it was the definition of the white man's mission.
Yeah, eventually it did get the paper boycotted.
Well, we were, you said making money. I didn't know newspapers made money until the late 1960s. We were in the red the first 4 months of every year. After the Supreme Court decision, when Dad went from being sort of a careful moderate to a less careful moderate and said the Supreme Court decision of 54 is a law of the land, not something you were supposed to say at the time, and then took on the organized racist. We were under organized boycott, very effective organized boycott, from 1955 mm-hmm. until about 1969 or 70.
And yet the paper survived.
We survived because Dad, among other things, was a prolific writer. 22 books, about 500 magazine articles, and that was sort of what sustained us, and the rest was what we made. Anybody who knows anything about cash flow, if I tell you the biggest money I ever saw us make before taxes was $80,000 a year, and we employed 50 people, you understand how tight it was.
Wow. Well, then what made you decide to go into the business?
What I decided to my own satisfaction by the time I was out of high school was that I was never going to go in that business. My father was not only famous and visible, he had pretty well created the mold, and I couldn't see my trying to fit it. And so I went off to college to go in the Foreign Service. And my dad, toward the end of my time, not in college, but in the Marine Corps, said, "You owe it to me. You got to come back. You got to give it at least a year. See whether it will work or not." And so my wife and I talked about it and said, okay, 1 year. We went home, fell into the campaign of 1959, which elected one of the notorious racists, Ross Barnett. I loved every second of it. We went to war, and we didn't come out of war for the whole time I was there, which was to say I followed in my father's footsteps and discovered I liked it. It was probably useful in the end, since he was as vigorously opinionated as a man could be, and I was too, that he, in declining health, essentially handed it over to me when I was arrogant and ignorant and about 27 years old. And so I had to make all my mistakes on my own without somebody constantly telling me I was making all those mistakes.
It's a Wonderful Life 2, starring Hodding Carter III. So now you're taking on some pretty serious topics, too, and doing some tough investigations, including the White Citizens Councils, looking into them.
We spent a lot of time on that. My senior thesis at Princeton, as a matter of fact, had been on the Citizens Councils. It was published by Doubleday under the title Moderate, The South Strikes Back. But Dad had been their enemy throughout from their creation on. I came back. They were the leaders of the boycott, of course. And they were the people who controlled the politics of Mississippi, not so much because a secret society controlled it. They were a quite public society of bankers, lawyers, businessmen, the leadership of the state, plus some who weren't leadership types but who were attracted to it. They were very tough, and they elected three straight governors in my time back there who were, to the last ounce, nasty racists. It was not amusing. The best thing for you to do was to announce to the world that the Delta Democrat Times of Greenville, Mississippi was for your opponent. At that point, your opponent was dead and you were done. It was a very, very tough time.
Well, and violent, too. Did you?
Oh, well, there was violence. I came out of the Marines, a tough little boy, 59, came back, immediately discovered just how hot it was, and as my father before me, carried a gun literally on myself, in my car, in my desk drawer at work, and most of the places in the house for 5 years. I did it because, to my own satisfaction, I needed to. I did it because real people were being killed by real people in that state. In retrospect, it turns out, white Southern boys were not being killed by the racists. Everybody else was being killed by the racists. But you don't notice that at the time that your enemies are basically turning a blind eye while the really, truly feral killers were going after people.
You used that word moderation in your thesis, ironically, to talk about this moderation in the South that sooner or later we'll get there. Don't press it. But you yourself went through a moderate phase and realized that.
Absolutely. Any white man of the South at that time who tells you he came full-blown out of his mother's womb, his integration is lying to you. I'm sorry. It ain't the way it worked. It was a totally closed society built around that orthodoxy. and you had to wrench yourself out of it. I was luckier than most people. Dad had begun that journey ahead of me and had led the way and had somehow survived. So I understood that you could, but doesn't matter, though. It was a period. It wasn't until the mass burnings, killings, the freedom summer of 64 that I looked up and said, I'm sorry, I can't be careful anymore. I mean, it's over. And it was that summer which also said, I'm sorry, I can't be an honest journalist. I've got to get involved also.
We'll talk about that involvement, how Hodding Carter III got involved in politics, and what led him to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. All of that as our conversation with Hodding Carter continues on the State of Things just ahead. What's it like to be the voice of the State Department? This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking with Hodding Carter III, a professor of leadership and public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, but he did a few things before that. So we're talking about your moment now when you realize that writing about it's not good enough, you've got to get involved. And how did you imagine that? What did you think you were going to be doing in politics?
I actually didn't know. I did two things that sort of determined it for me, though. One, I was running the paper in Mississippi during all this bloody business, and my reporters were coming back from the field as I'd been seeing what really it all meant if you were going to be simply an observer, that you were going to be observing horror. The second thing was I covered for the paper the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City and the Republican Convention, more to the point, in San Francisco. And the new Goldwater majority was saying, in effect, to the South, as I heard it, we're with you. Actually, the Civil Rights Act of 64, which had passed by then, is something which is an abomination. We are on your side. And I thought to myself, no. If that's going to be the case, then you've got to spend some time working against this. We just are walking out of that. So, as it turned out, I went off and worked for Lyndon Johnson briefly as speechwriter and propagandist and general dog's body of no great consequence. Came back, but having met a lot of people in Washington in that brief time, some of whom contacted me in 65 and said, hey, we have a chance to start rebuilding a party which is open to blacks, which is honestly open, and it doesn't have to be entirely civil rights movement. We'd like you to see if you could also get a few whites from Mississippi in it. And that sort of through the door I came in was to try to bring some of the young guys. And let me say really clearly that the heroes of this whole period were, of course, black Mississippians and their civil rights assistants. I was not a hero of that period. I became a participant with them, but not in them. And you have to really know that. And a lot of folks who hear me described as a civil rights worker will say, are you kidding? That guy was sitting there in that big newspaper, blah, blah, blah. And it was true. But little by little, I got involved with and finally reached a point of involvement as the president of the state reconstituted Young Democrats that I was part of the process that sent an alternative delegation to the Democratic Convention in 1968, and we replaced the white delegation. And our delegation was half black, half white, and so on. And I was a co-chairman of it with a very brave man named Aaron Henry, who longtime head of the NAACP. It was an incredible thing. It had the negative effect of me now becoming absolutely known to all the white folks of Mississippi. Before, Hodding Carter was better known as a guy with a big mustache, dark glasses, and somewhat heavy and white hair. Now, all of a sudden, Hodding Carter was more visible as something other than that.
There's another one. Yeah.
There's another one. And I could have done without that part of the identification, but Chicago finished it off.
So now you're involved. You made the effort to integrate the delegation to the convention, and you're going to get more involved in politics. And you hook up with a guy named Terry Sanford, who we will know here in North Carolina.
Well, there's several things that happened, actually, which was stunning. I was, of course, absolutely in love with Terry Sanford, as any white liberal or moderate in the South had to be, because he was the model of what could be, as opposed to the idiots you were living under were doing. I mean, not Ross Barnett, not George Wallace. He was a man who spoke in terms of moderate determination that we would move forward together rather than banging our heads against the wall. and had seen him at the Kennedy inauguration in 1960, where I practically slobbered all over him when I went running over to tell him how great he was. And that was my only real contact. Post-1968, I was on a couple of reform commissions that the Democratic National Party had established. I might add one of them, the O'Hara Rules Reform Commission with Jim Hunt, later to be lieutenant governor and governor from North Carolina. And that put me into touch ultimately with something that was created out of the 72 convention, which was a charter, no, out of 68's. In any case, a charter reform effort to reform the Democratic Party, chaired by Terry Sanford. And there was when we really got connected. It was out of that contact that I decided he ought to be president of the United States, as did others. And in 1972, I had the great pleasure of nominating him for president at the 1972 Democratic Convention in Miami. Terry, of course, was already dead in the water, but it was fine by me and fine by him to put his name out there as what he was, the best that the South could offer.
So then tell us, because you were not, Jimmy Carter was a name at this time, a rising star in the party, albeit not as well known nationally. But at the time, you didn't think much of him.
Well, at the time, I did not think as much of him as I was going to. He had done a couple of things or was going to do a couple of things that I found to be sort of absurd, like pronouncing Lieutenant Calley Day in Georgia, Calley being the one of the perpetrators of the massacre at My Lai. Yeah. And in any case, Terry was my beau ideal, so everything was invidious comparison thereafter. He did, as I say, did not run well in 72. And two people I cared about a lot, Andy Young and the woman who is now my wife, Pat Darien, both came to me in the middle of the 1970s, 74, 75, and said, hey, the guy who actually can beat George Wallace in the South and thereby take his hand off the party is Jimmy Carter. To both of them, I said, are you kidding? And my wife said, he's good on civil rights. He's good on women. Andy Young said, listen, he's fine on civil rights, and he can beat George Wallace in Florida. And that's what you got to think about. So, anyway, long
and ran. And he was one of the few people, in fact, maybe the only Southern governor who actually publicly met with Terry Sanford.
Listen, it's absurd. He was absolutely the only Southern governor who put himself out there in the McGovern campaign, proving obviously he must be thinking about public office, but he was amazing in that respect, and there were lots of things that were amazing about him which I didn't fully appreciate in that period of me, you know, Terry is it. No, I came across, finally started wearing my peanut around January of 76, went off and worked in the campaign after the nomination, not before. He won, and I decided that going off to work in Washington was something that really appealed to me.
And yet, you were passed over for a number of jobs until you finally got that
gig. Worse than that. Friends in the inner transition kept putting my name up, and it kept being vetoed. And finally, one of my really good friends, a longtime foreign policy guy and Arkansas man, called me up and said, Hodding, did you really do something to make – which one did you make mad? Was it Jody or was it Hamilton? Because it doesn't matter how what we put you up for, the veto comes down. I said, I didn't think I made anybody mad. He said, well, wait a minute. You'll get a phone call. A little while, the phone rings, and it's Jimmy Carter. He says, cousin, they tell me you want to work for me. I said, Governor, I've already been working for you. He said, Hodding, you told me 2 years ago when I visited Greenville, Mississippi, you couldn't leave your newspaper. I said, Governor, I have, and I want to. He said, good. Here's what you do. You call up Cy Vance, and I think he may have some job for you. Now, I didn't know Cy Vance from who was going to become the Secretary of State, from anybody. So I called him. I got a job about which I knew virtually nothing, having wished, of course, to be Deputy Secretary of State or something equally grand. And I come aboard as spokesman, which clearly was not going to make me a famous man.
No, it wasn't, and yet it did. But we should establish something right away. Yeah, although Jimmy Carter called you cousin, that's just a Southern formality, right?
That is not only a Southern formality. When he was hosting the American Society of Newspaper Editors Convention in Atlanta back in 73 or 74, there was a reception held for him by some people who knew he was running. And we went through the line, and I got to him. He said, "Hiding." He said, "I've been so proud of your daddy for so long." He says, "We must be relatives." And I said, "Governor, I don't know. Where are your people from?" He said, "South Carolina." I said, "Well, mine came down through West Virginia and then down Louisiana. I don't think we're related, Governor." And that was it. I kissed him off, went on. 1977, flying into Geneva, we go in to meet Assad of Syria. We're getting off the plane. He looks back at me coming back from the back of the plane. He says, "Are you ready to call me Ken now?" He had remembered 3 years earlier that I had denied any relationship. So cousin it became, but he was already calling me cousin.
Cousin, but no relation. So now this is really the kind of the ideal job. A journalist who studies foreign policy is mm-hmm. now the chief spokesman to reporters for the State Department.
Who and- all looked up and said, "What is this clod doing with this job? What is a small town editor from Mississippi doing with this job?" Famously, one of the great writers about foreign policy wrote a piece in New Republic about the new team. And in that piece, he said this about this and this about that, and Dick Holbrooke is brilliant and blah, blah, blah. "The worst appointment," he said, "is Hiding Carter, who the State Department regulars already are saying has done the worst briefings in the briefing room of anybody in history," which was a great story, except I hadn't been doing any briefings because I had not yet been confirmed. He just assumed I was going to do bad briefings. It turned out, of course, that one of the great things about being a journalist taking that job is I understood what the guys were about in the room. I wasn't offended, and we got along just fine.
One of the things that may have helped was that you were the first to allow cameras in that room.
Well, that helped okay with television. The print guys were not amused. I mean, they thought that it changed the atmospherics, and it did, of the briefing room, made the spokesman perhaps a little more careful than he might have been otherwise. But you know what? As I told the secretary when they came to me with their list of non-negotiable demands, I said, "This is an easy one to give because nobody cares about the State Department briefings. They're not going to use the opportunity except occasionally." And I was right for a couple of years.
For a while.
For a while.
And then you became famous.
And then it was every day, bang, 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 all the cameras, all the lights, day in, day out. And I didn't have much new to say every day, but it was a great thing.
I want to ask you about that. We have a clip from that era, and I was looking. I couldn't even find the date, but you get the feeling that the hostage crisis had gone on for a while by now. Let's listen.
"I don't want to try to give you any new rendition of what is an old and unhappy record. We continue to seek the release of the hostages through diplomatic channels. You have seen the activities of a number of nations and individuals. We continue to welcome that activity and to hope that the cumulative effect will finally be felt by the authorities in Iran and that they will release the hostages."
What goes through your mind as you hear that clip now?
What goes through my mind is when I went into television after I left the administration, was on a couple of times, I came home from something. And my wife said to me, "You know, you had to be the most boring man in the world when you had the job at State, but you're supposed to show a little animation now. You might want to sort of take off the spokesman hat and put on the human being hat." Well, a lot of it was just simply tedious repetition. Nothing was going on. Every now and then, it was fun. I took to throwing rubber chickens at some of the reporters who were bugging me and brought a golf club in one day to sort of be playing with it to prove that I could do three things simultaneously because they weren't asking me anything new and that sort of thing.
Singing debut, your rendition of Call Me Irresponsible.
Well, the Call Me Irresponsible was because I'd gone up to give a talk at Princeton, talked to a bunch of undergraduates who were supposedly wanting to talk off the record to the notable spokesman. Five of them were taking notes under the table. One of the things I said was the most irresponsible act I'd ever seen were the networks bowing the head and saying, "Oh, Iman, oh, Iman, oh, Ayatollah, what should we do to get out the hostages?" And I said, that was the most irresponsible thing I'd ever seen. Well, the kids put it all out on the wires. It ran everywhere. Three network vice presidents demanded that I be fired for being an enemy of the free press. So I came into the briefing room the next day at noon, walked in, said, "I do have one announcement today," and started singing. "Call me irresponsible." It did not help. They beat the Jesus out of me for a full hour, asking me what was I thinking. And I said, well, I frankly, I was wondering what you were thinking. But
Well, what was it like going out there day after day, 444 days, 443 of them during the Carter administration?
Well, just for correction, I actually left before it was over. Cy Vance resigned after the thing. I loved Ed Muskie. I'd worked with him in politics. But I just woke up one day and said, actually, I had become Vance's guy more than Carter's, and I was a little unhappy about some aspects of things in any case. And might have been tired, may not have been. I don't remember being tired. But you're asking me what it was like, however long it was. For the most part, it was about as dramatic as what you just heard on that recording. Sometimes it was heartbreaking, and sometimes it was frustrating beyond belief. I have to tell you, at the end of the day, neither the press nor the government did a very good job of understanding and covering that entire event. We played it as melodrama, and we played it as a sort of a thematic thing. There weren't very many experts, frankly, on Iran anywhere. And the understanding that we should have had was this was yet another step toward the consolidation of the revolution of the Imams, and that this thing became a great way to flush out the moderates who kept trying to end the stalemate, and each one would be executed in turn once it became clear that he was there. It was also not just that. I was traveling constantly with the secretary. While we had Camp David underway, while we were normalizing full relationship with China, while we were trying hard to bring one man, one rule, one person rule to Southern Africa, while we were in the middle of massive negotiations on nuclear stand down weaponry with the Soviet Union. So it wasn't just doing those briefings.
Tell me a little bit more about something you said earlier. You said, I realized I was more becoming Cy Vance's man, not the president's. Mm-hmm. Of course, Cyrus Vance retired or resigned over the failed rescue attempt. He obviously didn't agree with that should go forward. It failed. He resigned. But what does it mean to be the president's man versus the secretary's man? And then there's your what you believe. And I'm guessing you didn't agree with everything that you had to announce.
Well, I didn't agree with everything, and there's no point in anybody pretending that he or she does. It's almost, I would hope, impossible. I don't think anybody's that much of a knee-jerk or rigid or ideologue. But I did pretty well sort of in the same sort of balancing act that I felt about how could I take the government's bread, having been the press's holy representative for a long time. How could I go out there and pronounce on subjects about which I was dubious or, in fact, opposed? And the answer was because about 80% of it I agreed with totally. And I had discovered, having written some 5,000 or 6,000 editorials in the process of getting to that point, had discovered that I could be wrong from time to time, or let us say I could be repetitively wrong over time, and therefore was not so doggone sure as I'd once been that if I thought something, ergo, it was true, and that if I disagreed with something, ergo, it was wrong. And because I trusted the instincts, basically, of the people, the president on, I just sat there and said, okay, you go out there, you do your duty, and you understand that the point of the exercise is you are presenting a position. And it is a point of the opposition and of the press to not just sit there and take the pronouncement of the spokesman. The point is now to go to the democratic process and go at it. In fact, when some of the reporters from time to time would say, Hodding, why don't you tell us the truth? And I'd say, if you were my reporter and you came home saying, I expected a spokesman to tell me the truth, I'd fire you. I'd fire you, which is a distinction I want to make very quickly. I never lied, and this just happens to be the truth. It is also the truth that I didn't always tell the truth. And what does that mean? That means I did not lay all the facts out, you know, and I did not tell everybody, well, we actually voted 8-7. In favor of this policy, and here are the reasons for the people who were against it. That would have been a larger truth. I went out and said, here's the reasons we're for this policy. That was also factual. It was not the large truth.
And as you say, that's the job of the press then, to figure out who was for it, who was against it, why, and what is
to
the debate,
to work,
even within the administration.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I want to find out more, because you said something that was interesting as well about the divisions over these policies, but also, you know, the question of how you make a choice to go back every day when it's a kind of a tedious job. We're going to talk more with Hodding Carter III, professor of leadership and public policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, former State Department spokesman in the Jimmy Carter administration. That conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Hodding Carter III, a professor of leadership and public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, served in the State Department as spokesman during Jimmy Carter's administration, also worked in TV news on CNN, PBS, and NBC. You said that before the break, you said it was badly mishandled. The press didn't understand the story, the Iran hostage story. The government didn't quite understand it. Knowing what you know now, how should the government have handled that?
Well, actually, the way that Ronald Reagan was to handle the hostage business that he had, with hostages held a lot longer than the time that our embassy was held.
No, that was in Lebanon, remember?
It was.
Yeah.
But in the same way that Lyndon Johnson had handled the seizure of an entire vessel by the North Koreans. I mean, you didn't go out there and talk about it every day. You essentially just said, okay, this is a situation, and we're going to do a lot of effort, and we're going to do a lot of diplomacy. And if you're going to be asked by the press, what are you doing? You're going to say, we're doing a lot, and it won't help any of it if we talk to you about it. And then everybody beats on you a little bit. But, you know, I hate to say this, having been in the business more than I was anything else, but we of the press are like fleas. We bite until nothing is coming from that bite, and we jump to something else. We don't have a lot of staying power on things if we're not given some response. It was not stupid. It was, in fact, intelligent, and I thought so, within the limited context of the administration's needs, for me to take over the role of the daily explainer. Since we weren't going to use military force, since the Carter absolutely believed that would be a disaster, since Cyrus Vance, who had been Secretary of Army, Deputy Secretary of Defense, knew it would be a disaster. We didn't do it for quite a long time, so you had to do something, thought the White House, to take the bug off of the White House. So the State Department spokesman became the go-to. And all of a sudden, it was a ritual which consumed the substance. See the bad mob in the streets, see the white hat spokesman, get your evening fix. Day 222 of Hussey's Crisis, Walter Cronkite.
Well, Walter Cronkite, and of course Nightline was born in this. And I'm wondering if it was true that the public and the press would have gotten off this. I mean, Nightline certainly was a program that was born of this crisis.
It was right. It was born by Frank Reynolds, who was in the anchor, and Frank did it for the first few weeks. And indeed, just to be clear about this, after 2 weeks, I called him up. And I said, I just want to say on behalf of the administration, we appreciate this concern the ABC is showing about this subject. I would have called him up and said, thank you for not doing it anymore after a while. But there was a sense, by the way, that this thing was not going to run forever. We had, after all, had hostages seized just back in February, January of the same year. And a guy who was a deputy foreign minister, Yazdi, got him out after a couple of days, and that same type of people kept telling us that they would be able to do it and over time. And then various intermediaries kept suggesting they could do it. Well, it turned out, of course, this time there wasn't going to be any quick deliverance, but you didn't know that if you were in the White House. And so you thought, well, okay, we'll just see what we can do to hold this thing off. And so everything was tried right on up until April, at which point there was intense negotiation going on by Hamilton Jordan with a man who was then the foreign minister, Mr. Gospodeh, and all sorts of things involving red wigs and traveling around and secret missions. Eventually got Gospodeh killed. But in the meantime, it collapsed, which led directly to the failed raid. But before it collapsed, I was told to shut up and just quit going down that line anymore. And you can go look this up. Over the two-week period in which I was no longer actually responding every day, it went off the front page of every newspaper in America. It did not end Nightline. It did not end Walter Cronkite. But it put the story way down while I was being silent. Of course, in the White House, never wanted to talk about it. So if I didn't talk, it was very hard to construct a story if you didn't have the this and the that sound of this story. Now, whether that could have been maintained forever, Lord only knows. I will only say that perhaps more adroit people than us in the Reagan administration maintained it right up until the time that he finally couldn't stand it anymore and, hating that hostages were being tortured, went into Iran-Contra and the entire failed deal to try to get hostages out, which he swore he would never do.
Never negotiate with terrorists.
Never.
And his base loved that.
Yes.
He didn't pay the price. He didn't pay a
price for negotiating
with terrorists and breaking the law.
I was watching a HBO show the other night and forgotten what blatant lies were being said by a number of people about that period. And because it was Ronald Reagan and George Bush, who said some stunning lies, the elder, they got to walk it right on through. But it doggone near brought him down. People forget just how close that one came. But in any case, we didn't fully appreciate the nature of that revolution. We had bad, frankly, intelligence about the place. Does that strike you as familiar when thinking about more recent events than intelligence?
Yeah, but the outcomes are different. Well, first, let me ask you if you think that the handling of the hostage crisis and the crisis itself was what denied Jimmy Carter a second term.
I think you can't be a Democratic president and have high unemployment of 8 million or so people, have a runaway inflation and interest rates at, 20% and 12%, the figures I remember, 2012-8. These were lethal for a Democrat. There was also lethal to have the hostage crisis unresolved. It was also lethal that by that time the narrative script about Jimmy Carter was that he was weak and not able to sustain toughness out there, and that the Russians were coming, and then there was Afghanistan, though Afghanistan was interesting in that somebody should have said, oh, please, to the Russians, please have Afghanistan. It will destroy you.
Right.
But all of this was true. Incidentally, by the way, just for the record, in Jimmy Carter's presidency, the Russians lost more territory than that little bit that they took in Afghanistan. The great debate in Moscow was who lost China. Who lost Egypt? I mean, these are things that happened in our time.
Well, yeah, and certainly the Camp David, Sadat, and Begin, that agreement was monumental.
Of course it was.
And one that we're still – in fact, we talk about it today when we look at what's happening now in the Middle East. We go back to that document and those negotiations.
I have to say something which, if I don't, I can't go home, but it's also because it's true. One of the great reasons that I was able to say yes to some things I didn't like was that a centerpiece of Carter's foreign policy was a human rights policy, which was real and was put in place by the woman who is my wife, who happened to be both tough and clear and cool and collected and consistent and faced down more dictators than anybody I think I've ever known. I know I've ever known. But that was a policy of great meaning applied uniformly, despite what some of the right wing like to say. And was something which history will always remember Jimmy Carter for.
When you then you get back into the journalism business, although this time in TV, what was that transition like for you?
Well, honestly, what had happened was that the extended families that owned our family newspaper, my partner's family, my mother, my brother, were to the last person save me really ready not to be in the business anymore. My partner had been doing it with my dad since the 30s, in the hard times. We were now making money. It was amazing. We were actually making money in the late 60s and 70s. I'd said that, okay, if you get an offer at a certain point, I will be willing to talk about it, but don't talk to me until then. And a fateful day in February of 80, I get a phone call from my partner. He says, all right, the offer has been made. And I want to tell you, you're the last one I'm coming to, your mother, your brother, everybody else in the family. If you don't want to do it, I would understand it, but you got to buy us out at this thing. So the boy who went off saying he'd be back in 4 years suddenly did not have a place to go back to. It was well recompensed. God knows it still hurts. Not that I'm telling you they busted my head to do it, but it still hurts because it had been such a central part of so many things. The paper was sold. What was I going to do? I quit the administration. I had become visible. An agent calls me up and says, hey, I can make you a star. I mean, you are already so well known. In retretrospect, I keep wondering, what did he think he saw? I mean, that guy. And I went into a new television show we put together called Inside Story, which ran for 4 years critiquing the press. Some people thought it was because I was mad at the press, which is absurd since I really like them. But in any case, and really bad. Oh, I was so bad. And I was so visibly bad there in my early middle age. And then we won about 4 Emmys, national Emmys for it. And I wasn't so bad, which was a good deal. Then did a terrible show about Congress for 2 years.
Well, what do you make of journalism today? Are we getting it right to some extent? To what extent are we, and how aren't we?
Well, what you have that you have to be most frightened about is not the end of newspapers, though I personally think that their weakened and dying condition is not a great thing for the republic. What you have to worry about is who and what is actually paying for real reporting. I'm not talking about opinion blogs. I'm not talking about living off the seed corn of others. Where are the reporters coming from? Who's paying for people on the ground who are professional reporters? And the answer is less and less and less and less. I was talking to a guy from Time magazine who used to be chief of correspondence for them. He used to have 125 correspondents solely owned by Time magazine abroad. Does Time magazine have anybody abroad? If so, two? I mean, we have seen the death of a great deal of professional coverage of not merely abroad. You don't want to go over to Raleigh and see how many papers aren't routinely covering it anymore. You don't want to go to City Hall and see how routinely things aren't covered there every day. This is bad news. The good news is, of course, that we are essentially in the new frontier of communication, where we used to be when any guy with a shirt full of type could start a paper in the old America. We have this proliferation of things going on out there, out of which can come, and you have to pray will come, a new configuration, just like all those guys with all those newspapers all over the place. Utterly terrible, non-professional, all of that in the old days in America, out of which comes a professional press corps, which is print. Television was a mess. Radio was a mess. Out of that came some professionalism for a while. So the new frontier of blog and internet and the whole wide world is at least potentially going to solve some of our problem. In the meantime, to answer your question, it's bad news because there's not enough news and there's a wide variety of opinion.
Well, and you're somebody who believes in what we call advocacy journalism.
I do. Absolutely.
What does that mean, and how do you stay professional, and what does it look like?
That's very good. Well, I think the way it looks is the way the press looked in America for most of the history of the press in America, which was enlisted in a cause, and indeed the way the press looks in most sections of the world outside of the United States. I mean, I am less worried about whether there's a Fox this or a something that, as I am that there's not adequate variety of that range of opinion. Advocacy journalism is one kind of thing, but something else I believe in even more than advocacy, which is the voice you're given by the First Amendment, which was not given to people who are restrained, polite professionals kissing the hem of power. The people who had the press when we got the First Amendment were nasty little partisans of no great professional achievement. What worries me, really, to repeat, is the absence of enough reporters. I've been involved with a couple of organizations creating new platforms of investigative journalism, the Center for Public Integrity being one, a great investigative journalism center. And these kinds of things are producing good material, but I don't care how many of them get created. They cannot possibly fill the void left from the how many cutbacks now at the News and Observer?
They're down to two-thirds of what they once were. One-third of what they once were. Lose two-thirds of your staff.
My newsroom at the Delta Democrat Times of Greenville, Mississippi, when I left there in 1976, had more daily reporters in it than all the dailies and weeklies in the Delta of Mississippi together, including my old newspaper, have. Right there, I'm telling you what's wrong.
If it goes on long enough, do you worry we lose the appetite for good journalism? In other words, we don't know what we're missing anymore. We don't even demand it.
I think that it was a great American named Willard Wirtz who once said that when people say that we're only giving them what they want, you have to ask, what's the diet you give them? That is, people get to know a diet, and they think that's what good eating is. And it can be candy. It can be steak. It can be balanced with lots and lots of veggies. But it is not automatic function of the man in the street to know what ought to be professional journalism. And indeed, one of the things we were doing wrong before the collapse was we were listening too much, people telling us we have to give them what they want. Well, yeah. No doctor says that.
Well, even after the fact, we've got a cataclysmic economic meltdown caused by fraud on Wall Street. Fraudulent systemic financial practices. No one has gone to jail, and no one complains. As we heard it again last night at the Academy Awards. We hear it all, so it's not like we're not hearing it. We've heard it 1,000 times, and yet no one goes to jail, and there's no clamor for anyone to be imprisoned for that fraud that hurt so many people.
It is stunning to me. I do not understand it. I have this feeling that there is at least some sense of resignation out there. The big boys never, ever pay. There was the old song. It's the poor, you know, it's the rich that gets the gravy, gravy, gravy. It's the poor that get the blame. It's the same the whole world over, and it all a bloody shame. And great books, great documentaries, great, well, not so great hearings, but some good hearings, all to the end of, we need less regulation.
And let's blame the unions.
Yeah, well, please blame the union.
By all means, the unions fought less regulation.
And as that boy said last night at the Academy Awards, I mean, this is criminal behavior for which no one has paid a criminal penalty.
Hiding Carter, thank you so much for being with us on the program.
It's great being here, and thank you, Frank.
Hiding Carter III served as State Department spokesman in Jimmy Carter's presidential administration. He has been a newspaper owner and editor and also now professor of leadership and public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. That's our program. Thanks for listening. We're at stateofthings.org. Follow us on Facebook. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.